Leuk, we zitten weer klaar voor een welsproken podcast. En dit is wel heel wat speciaals, want we gaan internationaal. We gaan kijken met Daniel Burger Udel. En dat is een Amerikaan die een heel mooi platform heeft opgezet. En dat platform dat heet WikiTongues. Laat gaan! And we're live. Thank you very much, Daniel, for taking the time to speak to us today, because you're a very special character. And there's something you do that many people have been wanting to do for a long time, and it's basically admirable and very noble of you to have this sort of thing. So what actually is WikiTongues? Can you explain us a little about it?
Absolutely. First of all, thank you for taking the time to chat with me. I know this podcast is normally in Low Saxon. And I'm sorry that I don't speak Low Saxon, but I'm happy to talk about this in English. So WikiTongues is a nonprofit organization that helps people get started with language documentation and language revitalization. So we help people get started with the social process of keeping their languages alive. We started in 2014 as a personal project, or I think it might have actually been 2013. And it was a YouTube channel of mine where I'd record people in the New York area where I live speaking in their mother tongues or their ancestral languages. I'd post those videos online, and we had a call to action for anyone to contribute videos from their communities or from their countries. And over time, our volunteer base that grew in response to that call to action was present in 130 countries, or it's present in 130 countries today. And the first couple of years, we hit a few dozen countries.
Wow.
That was evidence that people were really excited about this stuff. We obviously weren't the first project to emphasize linguistic diversity and to try to support linguistic diversity, but I think we had a kind of very accessible entry point, and so people were eager for that. So over time, people started asking, "How do I save my language?" Which, as a language activist, you know, is a very complex question with a variable set of answers. And in 2020, we started working with the Living Tongues Institute for Endangered Languages, which is another really awesome language diversity nonprofit, to try and develop an answer to that question. We published a document called the Language Sustainability Toolkit, which helps you think about what your language needs, how to go about implementing those needs, and how to go about measuring the success of your implementation over time. So it's essentially a document that helps you answer in a non-linear, non-prescriptive way, how do I save my language? And this year, I'm really, really excited to say that it's our first year operationally stable, which is another way of saying we actually have two employees. And
well done.
We've been able to distribute some grants to language activists in three countries who are working to launch language revitalization projects. And in addition to the money, we've been giving them advice, helping them strategize, and connecting them with linguists or other field experts who can help them. There are two other revitalization projects we're working with as well. And so that's five overall that we've helped kind of kickstart or accelerate this year. These activists are Wendy Goodlow from the Afro-Seminole Creole community in Texas and Coahuila, so Mexico and the United States. They tend to call themselves Black Seminoles, but their language is called Afro-Seminole Creole. And then we've got Hangi Bulebe in the Democratic Republic of Congo. His language is Kihunde. Kamran Ali from Pakistan, although he's living in Russia, his language is called Wahi. And Bintu Kamra from Guinea, her language is called Nalu. And then Sonia Rock from the Gikson Nation, First Nation in modern-day Canada. They have a language revitalization movement underway. A lot of First Nations in British Columbia are extremely active in keeping their languages alive, but they're the Gikson First Nations language, Gikson-Imak, only has one children's book. And so Sonia's goal in particular is to publish a second children's book and hopefully usher in demand for more literature and early childhood materials in her language. And so specifically, we've been helping her find a publisher for that. And so WikiTongues helps people get started with language revitalization, and we continue to maintain our open pipeline for language documentation. People from all over the world send us videos in their language. And another thing that we've been working on this year using Jewish diaspora languages as a case study is developing templates for more rigorous video documentation. Because when people send us content from all over the world, it varies in depth and quality quite a lot. And so we're trying to figure out an elicitation protocol that can support, you know, hours of educationally useful video language, like video documentation of languages, so that
minimum requirements.
Exactly. So that you're preserving, when in recording these videos, you're preserving the language well enough that someone could learn it or produce learning materials from the video in for a future revitalization movement.
All right. So that sounds all very lovely, but one big question for you. Why? Why would you do that? And why would you, Daniel Berger Udell, care about all these languages around the world?
Well, personally, I come from marginalized language communities. My grandparents were Yiddish speakers. On my father's side, and then on my mother's side, my great grandparents were actually Scottish Gaelic speakers. Both of these languages are at risk today, Scottish Gaelic more so than Yiddish, because of political intention. It was English only policies in Great Britain that drove Celtic languages into decline, and it was the genocidal violence of the Holocaust that drove Yiddish into decline. Around the world, almost every endangered language community is having a hard time keeping their language alive because they've been oppressed, persecuted, or marginalized in some way. People don't wake up and voluntarily give up their language. It's why indigenous languages in the Americas and Australia are among the most at risk in the world, because they too have faced genocidal violence over the past four centuries. And on top of that genocidal violence, programs designed to eradicate their languages in the United States and Canada, for example, until the 1980s, or I think late 1970s, it differs by country, but indigenous kids were taken from their families and forced into abusive boarding schools where they were given English names and punished often violently for speaking their languages. We're just starting to investigate the ramifications of this in the US, but over the past several months in Canada, they've been unearthing mass graves at all of these schools. So these schools were not just assimilation schools, but sites of genocide, physical genocide, where people were murdered en masse and disposed of anonymously. In Australia, they had a very similar scheme. The generations that were forced into these schools are called to remember today as the Stolen Generation, because they were physically ripped from their families. There was no attempt by the Australian government to convince Aboriginal Australians and Torres Strait Islanders to send their kids to these schools. They would just show up and kidnap them. And this is true everywhere, right? In Mexico, until 2003, it was illegal to ban the use of indigenous languages in Mexican public schools. In countries across Europe, in Spain, it was, all of their languages were persecuted until the transition of the democracy in 1980. France still has yet to ratify the European Charter for Regional and Minority Languages. So even though things are better there than they were 50 years ago, language discrimination is still legal to a degree. And we could go on and on, like this is everywhere. So, keeping language diversity alive isn't an esoteric thing. It's a fundamental question of social justice and also human rights, because the Universal Declaration of Human Rights specifically stipulates that you have the right to speak your language and you have the right to keep your language alive. So, you know, making it possible for all people to keep their languages alive is about making it possible for all people to sustain their relationships with their ancestors, to keep their communities intact, and to express themselves freely, to be who they are in the 21st century. This isn't an argument for monolingualism. In fact, it's an argument for robust multilingualism. Lingua francas like standard Arabic or English or Spanish can coexist with, you know, the 7,000 other languages that humanity has developed over the past, you know, 50 to 100,000 years. So I just think a really, really important thing. If you care about social justice, if you care about a more equitable and fairer world, it's also good for science, because the vast majority of languages have unique vocabulary that often reflect biocultural knowledge of the natural world. And so there are fields of biology, ethnobotany, ethno-ornithology that leverages the vocabulary of languages from biodiverse regions to identify and fast track the conservation efforts of at-risk species, right? There are efforts to uncover medicinal knowledge or knowledge of the medicinal value of plants. Language diversity also helps us understand prehistory better, right? So like there's evidence of contact between Northern Australian cultures and Indonesian traders. This isn't a written history, but you can actually find it reflected in some languages from Northern Australia.
Or Polynesians.
I'm sorry?
And Polynesians?
Polynesians, sure, yeah. That's actually, so you bring up Polynesians, right? Like the migration of Polynesian people across the Pacific Ocean is also, you know, not a thoroughly written history, but it can be traced archaeologically by oral tradition, of course, and also the way that Pacific languages change across vast distances. There's evidence of the Bantu migration in Africa, similarly the Bering Strait migration from Siberia into the Americas, you know, 10 to 20,000 years ago. So there's so much that we have to learn from linguistic diversity that is important, even if the question of social justice doesn't particularly resonate with you. So there's a whole host of reasons, existentially and personally, that I care about this stuff. Mm-hmm.
And even beyond those things, you know, like the plant knowledge, plant-based knowledge, and the medicinal things, all these things. It's just as soon as a people decide that their language is worth preserving, or is in fact a basic set of knowledge and linguistic knowledge and what have you, it's worth preserving because they say so. You have no right to question that. And so whenever someone says, you know, so-and-so language isn't actually a language because it's so similar to that, this or that, to me, that's nonsense, because as long as the people believe that it's different and worth preserving, or, you know, worth standing up for, then to me, that's, you know, grounds enough to step up for it.
And, 100%.
And, you mentioned that you have loads of different projects across the world, in Africa, in Australia. What are typical things you come across in all these different languages and all these different communities?
What are typical things that we come across? What are universal themes that we find?
Mm-hmm. Yes, exactly.
That's a very good question.
And it's a very broad question, I know.
Yeah. I think the most universal theme at the moment is that people all over the world are afraid of losing access to the past. I think this is why, and I think this is related to emergent interest in traditional textiles, emergent interest in like farming techniques, and emergent interest in simply, you know, not forgetting the old ways, and not staying stuck in the old ways, but finding a way to carry the old ways into the future. Because like there are good things about the present, the internet, that you and I can have this conversation, you know, across a vast distance in real time, mm-hmm. and share that knowledge easily with people all over the world is a beautiful thing, right? So people everywhere are aware that we've lost a lot in the past couple hundred years, and people everywhere are keen on preventing any more loss, or at least at the very, very least, ensuring that that loss isn't irreparable.
Mm-hmm.
Because, you know, languages can go extinct and be revitalized at a later date, as long as they are well enough preserved.
Mm-hmm. Because, you know, the most perfect example of that would be Hebrew, which was extinct for how long? Maybe 2,000 years or 3,000 years? I'm not sure. But it's been revitalized because they had their own place to go and implemented as the first language to use on a daily basis. So
yeah, so it was dormant as a spoken language for about 2,000 years. You know, it's very hard to mark the exact date of its original fall into dormancy. Somewhere between the you know, 4th century BC and the 2nd century AD. So essentially when the kind of ancient Hebrew-speaking kingdoms of Judea and Israel were annexed first by Babylonians and later by Romans. It was kind of under that political context that Jewish people initially switched to Aramaic as a mother tongue. Well, we developed kind of like a Jewish Aramaic language that's still spoken today, by the way. And kind of turned to Hebrew as a means of cultural survival and preservation, as a philosophical language, as a liturgical language, and as a literary language. And so for the 2,000 years of Jewish life in between, you know, the extinction of Hebrew and the revitalization of Hebrew, it was still very actively used, just not as a mother tongue. Nobody spoke it natively. But because it was actively used, it was incredibly well preserved and actually had evolved over time too. So, you know, the language wasn't stuck in the Bronze Age because Jewish people were still writing in it, you know, well into the 1600s, 1700s. And so in the 1800s, you know, people associate the revitalization of Hebrew with specifically with the creation of Israel. And there's reason for that because it's, you know, Israeli Jews are the primary like Jewish group whose mother tongue is Hebrew. However, by Israel's independence in 1948, Hebrew was already revitalized. So the revitalization of Hebrew actually began in the 1800s as an effort to facilitate communication between different Jewish groups and as an outgrowth of this movement called the Haxalah, or the Jewish Enlightenment. And so this is where, you know, secular Judaism and secular Jewish identity really started to take a coherent form. And in that, there was this push to revitalize the ancient ancestral language that would be the common ancestral language of Jewish people. And in fact, the guy who kind of kickstarted this movement, Eliezer Ben Yehuda, credited an interaction they had with a Jewish person from another country whose mother tongue was different than his, and that person spoke to him in Hebrew. And he was like, wait a minute. And at least that's so the story goes. But anyway, it was definitely accelerated by migration, like mass migration of Jewish people to the land of Israel and Palestine, because you had Jewish people coming from different countries. Maybe they were speaking Judeo-Arabic, maybe they were speaking Yiddish, maybe they were speaking Ladino, and Hebrew became kind of like a, almost like a lingua franca between them. So there's some political conditions that definitely accelerated its revival, but it really began in private in the diaspora. And it really just started with an attempt to update some of the vocabulary, start speaking the language conversationally, and you know, raising new native speakers. But your point absolutely stands. It's, you know, by far the most successfully revitalized language in history. You know, they did it after 2,000 years of it being dormant. So, you know, it's absolutely possible to do.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. So there's hope, at least, if you document it properly. And mm-hmm. so that's one of your biggest focus areas, like documenting. How does that go about? You send out like volunteers with cameras and give them a certain framework, like it's all right if you start recording, but please follow these certain steps. And then what?
Well, we don't dispatch anyone with cameras, but if someone wants to go out and with their camera and start recording, we will help them figure out what languages are spoken, where they're going, and guide them through the process of, you know, doing outreach in a culturally sensitive way. Anyone can submit videos to us, and people often do in an unprompted way. They just go to our website, wikitongues.org/submit-a-video. And there they, upload videos. We have some guidelines for video creation, but they're pretty sparse. It's kind of like, these are questions you can ask. These are ways to maximize quality depending on your equipment. But what the new elicitation protocol that we're working on and that we'll publish by the end of the year has a kind of like seven chapters, really, of questions that you can ask people that we hope is culturally broad enough to apply to most languages. And that can be used for, recording hours and hours of useful content. Mm-hmm. Hopefully, we are growing fast. Ideally, we would have a proactive documentation budget where we could have two in-house field linguists who are dedicated to producing content of high quality and who had a budget to pay honorariums to native speakers for working with us. Because when the stuff is being elicited in a volunteer manner, that's incredible. But when you're starting to ask someone to sit down for, 8 hours, that's a lot of time. And they're sharing their knowledge, their cultural knowledge. And I think they deserve to be compensated for it.
Makes it more interesting, too.
Yes. And so that's the hope. That's the hope. But we're not there yet. Right now, mm-hmm. People can submit content. And if someone reaches out, says, I have a nice camera, I'm going on a trip, we'll help them plot mm-hmm. recording sessions along the way.
All right, so what's your biggest success number at this point?
Well, I mean, for me, honestly, helping getting 5 revitalization projects off the ground is the thing that I'm most excited about, because the only way we are going to measurably reverse the trend of language extinction over time is by, helping enough people start projects to keep their languages alive. Mm-hmm. But the bigger number is definitely languages that we have some kind of documentation in. I think the last time I checked, it was somewhere around 7 hours. 670 languages, something like that. And so we're almost at 10% of every language in the world, which is kind of fun. However, I should caveat that, in some cases, like we have a ton of videos of Kurdish, for example. I think we have a total like 5 or 6 hours of Kurdish, thanks to this one incredible teacher from Iraq. And I actually want to look up his name so we can give him a shout out, or from Kurdistan, depending on your persuasion. But yeah, his name is Daban Jaff. Is his name. He's a teacher in Iraqi Kurdistan. He recorded like hours of Kurdish content with his students. So like we have a ton of that.
I actually have Kurdish neighbors. So.
Oh, really?
So maybe they'll be interested, or maybe they even know him. Who knows?
That would be incredible. I'm also curious what variety of Kurdish they speak. Cause there's a couple like very distinct ones.
I think they're from Iraq.
Okay, so it's probably Central Kurdish, but I think Iraqi Kurdistan still has two Kurdish varieties. So we have a lot in that, right? We have a lot in Jewish Malayalam, for example, which is a very under-resourced Jewish diaspora language. So I'm actually really excited about that because that's a language that needs a lot more content. And so we've been actually moving the needle on that. But then there are some languages that maybe we have a 30-second video for. It was recorded on a smartphone somewhere. And I still think that's really awesome because that represents a connection to that community. And it means that someone in that community or someone who's close to that community is thinking about it. I would say the most critically under-resourced language we have content for is I need to look it up. It's a language from Vanuatu.
Oh, wow.
We have a ton of content from Vanuatu because when WikiTongues first got started, there was someone who worked for a media nonprofit in Vanuatu, and she just was constantly recording people. So we have a ton of incredible high-quality videos from that country. The most critically at-risk language for which we have some degree of documentation is the Lemerig language from Vanuatu. There are two known speakers, and as far as I know, yes. And as two speakers, and as far as I know, there's no revitalization initiative underway. So we have one oral history in the language that's about 5 minutes, and it's transcribed, and I'm very, very grateful that we have it.
It would be a bit of a pickle as well to get there, right? Because Vanuatu isn't just around the corner. It's very hard to get to.
It's hard to get to, yeah. But, you know, the people there are online. So, of course, digitally, it's quite easy to get to.
Mm-hmm. Sure. I was thinking just now, wouldn't you say that, and this is a bit of a side thought for me, that by dubbing a language a minoritized endangered language would be another blow, you know, another nail to the coffin, like how that would influence their thinking about the language as such, like... Wouldn't you agree that, you know, this language is worth saving? Oh, do you mean it was endangered?
Yeah,
I mean, how that implies that.
There's the discourse around endangered languages is definitely problematic. One of the reasons that, I mean, obviously we talk about endangered and at-risk languages because that is a phenomenon, right? If a language isn't being learned by the next generation at scale, it's, you know, its existence as a mother tongue is in doubt. Mm-hmm. So it is a real thing. And I don't think we need to mince words or like, you know, mm-hmm. dance around that reality. But
yep. I don't mean to attack you, but could it be a part of the toolkit, like making people stop saying like this, the language is on the brink of extinction, mm-hmm. but maybe focus more on, okay, we're going to improve things from here.
Right. Well, and I definitely didn't think you were attacking me. I was thinking circularly. So in our core like communications, we tend not to emphasize endangered languages. And we certainly don't discriminate. If somebody wants to work with us, we don't check to see if their language is endangered, like officially listed as endangered or not. Because you know, there's only like 100 or so languages whose, you know, future into the next set, whose, you know, future is all but guaranteed. The vast majority of languages are at risk in some way. And whether, you know, linguistically speaking, according to the EGID scale, it is definitely endangered, I think is kind of beside the point. And it can absolutely produce a fatalistic mindset, which is what you're speaking to. I think it's important to be honest and assess the vitality of your language if you're trying to get started revitalizing it. Mm-hmm. Because if you want to, you know, reach success, you need to know what you're reaching for. And if you're honest about the vitality, you can be clear about what it needs and how to go about that process of reawakening. But I would say that any time there's like a stable movement to keep a language alive, that language, you know, maybe could, it's not really reasonable to consider that language endangered anymore. It might be at risk, but it means that people in the community are working to keep it alive, right? So I would say that any language with that circumstances is reawakening. And I don't know, I tend to prefer the term at-risk language because I think it's a little broader in definition. Mm-hmm. It doesn't have the same implication. Like endangered starts to make it sound like an endangered species, mm-hmm. Which can be dehumanizing. I mean, I don't know. What do you think?
Just a moment back, you said that Hebrew was dormant instead of extinct. I think that is a nice way of thinking about it. Because as if it's asleep, you know, dormant, you can wake it up. But if it's extinct, there's no way of getting it back. And I don't know, it's some philosopher who said languages don't die, they're abandoned. So we need to bring the people back to the language. Like you said at the start, no person in their right mind will wake up one day and say, my language doesn't matter anymore, let's stop speaking it. That's always a guided process, right? And one language being prevalent over the other is always a directed sort of process. One language gets precedence over the other because some people think it's better inherently, which is nonsense. So, yeah, that would be a nice way of thinking about it in my book. But, yeah.
I like the term dormant for the same reason. And I forget who coined it. I've been seeing it used, especially among indigenous language activists in North America and Australia.
I think it's like an abandoned house, really, if you can think of it like that. It's like it's an empty house. It's still very much a house.
Mm-hmm. Well, and what I like about your abandoned formulation is it gives a lot of agency to the community, right? Because you can, you may have been forced to abandon your language, but it's still there for you.
Mm-hmm. And it may be a ruin.
If it's stolen, right? It's like it's gone, you know?
Exactly. It could be a ruin, but you can still build on the foundations to make something new out of it, but based on the old things, because you don't have to. It would be nonsense to think that you can, you know, revive a language, turn back time as it was to, you know, pick up where we left off, because that there's often a long stretch of time and lots of, you know, historical developments and technological developments that have created a need for new forms of the language, of new applications. And within the metaphor of the house, of course, sometimes you need to redecorate, right? Sometimes you need to, you know, change a door, or, you know, give it a new paint.
One of the languages that is the subject of one of our revitalization projects, the Afro-Seminole Creole language, there's only a couple dozen native speakers left. They have one 1,000-word dictionary and a grammar sketch.
Where's this spoken?
This is the Black Seminole community, and they're primarily in Texas and Coahuila, so kind of on the border of the U.S. and Mexico. Wendy, the activist that we giving the grant to, and who we're helping to kind of strategize around revitalizing the language, is working on this renovation process along the way. So she's not a native speaker; her aunt is. But Wendy's trying to inspire 20 people to commit to learning the language. So what she's really trying to do this year is seed a conscious community effort to revitalize Afro-Seminole Creole. But in doing so, you know, I mean, they can work with some of the last native speakers, although they're not all easily accessible. And they can work with this 1,000-word dictionary. But daily speech is 3,000 to 5,000 words. Right. So they have a lot of gaps to fill, and they may be able, working with the last native speakers, to get the other 2,000 to 4,000 words for daily speech from Afro-Seminole Creole as it was 50, 60 years ago. they're not going to be able to find vocabulary for everything. And so they're going to have to fill in the gaps. That's going to mean creating new words or borrowing words from similarly derived languages, right? So Gullah Geechee is another English Creole from the United States, and it's a sister tongue of Afro-Seminole Creole. So she'll be able to borrow from their vocabulary. There are a couple of English Creoles in Central America that also have some genealogical relationship to Afro-Sem. So she'll be able to borrow from those too.
Do you mean like right? in Belize or?
Yeah, actually, I think it may be in Belize. I think there's one in Honduras or Nicaragua. They're kind of like offshoots of Jamaican Creole or Jamaican Patois, as it's more commonly called, with mm-hmm. influence from Spanish and I think some Arawakan languages, mm-hmm. given the Caribbean influence. I mean, Afro-Seminole Creole has an amazing history. But what's fascinating about Afro-Seminole Creole is, it derives obviously from other Caribbean English Creoles, which themselves are derivative of 16th century English and a handful of West African languages like Wolof, Mende, and Vai. So already you have this amazing mix. In North America, enslaved people who were speaking Gullah or languages that approximated Gullah escaped slavery to Spanish Florida, where they came into contact with and at times joined the Seminole Nation, which was an amalgamation of Miccosukee and Creek people whose languages are Muscogean. So all of a sudden there's this Muscogean influence in Afro-Seminole.
Wow.
And then, they ended up in Texas on the border of and Coahuila. So that's the Mexican state that's next to Texas, right? And so then there's the Spanish influence. So there's just like layers of cultural history. And to think that for so long it was derided as a, broken English and, such history was ignored.
But that layer cake, that's an interesting concept as well, because the whole, spirit of the language is like borrowing here and borrowing there. So adding another layer would be just, within line of what the language has always been doing. So that's a new way of looking at it.
That's right, because languages are always changing. There mm-hmm. is no, I think one thing that happens in language revitalization sometimes is people get discouraged because they think they realize that they're not going to be able to restore the language as it was 200 years ago. Mm-hmm. But why would you want to do that?
Exactly.
If it had never gone extinct or if it had never become endangered, it still wouldn't be the same as it was 200 years ago.
And that's a very recognizable sentiment, because I recognize that from Low Saxon as well, because I sometimes get told off for, being too modern with the language and too forward, because most of the people who were involved in reviving the language or, preserving it, they're very much the elderly, right? And they want to go back to the language of their youth, because it has nostalgic value to them. But I always love to point out that, the point they're referring to in history, they're looking for the 1950s and the 1940s at this point, right? But if you look at the 1940s and the 1950s in light of what the language was around that day, it was already very much eroded. So I always keep pushing, telling them to go back at least an extra 200 years. And then they see the folly of what they're trying to do. But then again, I'm, I'm the one who's, who's mocking them. And, so I'm not sure if that's the right strategy, but I always get a few laughs from my contemporaries. So,
well, what this reminds me of, a few months ago, NASA landed a new rover on Mars, and this rover has a bunch of different things that are new and innovative about it. It has this little helicopter that's testing flying in the Martian atmosphere, which is new from a physics perspective because the gravity is different and also the atmosphere is a lot thinner. It also, if I'm not mistaken, is a rover that is going to be that was sanitized before it went, so mm-hmm. that it could in a safe way look for evidence of microbial life. It's doing a lot of really, really interesting things. And as every rover, as it goes along, it's naming geological features. So the place that it landed on Mars was named after a place in the Navajo Nation, which is one of the largest indigenous nations in the U.S. Their territory is usually omitted from maps, as all indigenous territories are. When you look at the U.S., you just see the states. You don't see the tribal territories. But if you see their tribal territory, it's huge. It's, you know, it's like a huge chunk of northwestern New Mexico and northeastern Arizona. And I think it bleeds into whatever is north of Arizona, Nevada or something like that. Anyway.
For my European viewers, that's somewhere southwest.
Yes, southwest. Southwestern
part of the U.S., right.
Right, so near the Grand Canyon and some of those geologically famous features. There was an engineer from in NASA. There is an engineer at NASA who is part of the team that's working on this rover, and he's from the Navajo Nation. And I believe he's the only Navajo team member at NASA. And he's definitely the only indigenous American like aerospace engineer. And he decided that since, you know, this rover is landing in a part of Mars that was named after a geological feature in the Navajo Nation, that it should name all of the things that it finds in Navajo. And so he went to his like team leader and pitched the idea. And then he went back to the Navajo Nation and the tribal government delegated a language team to help him put together kind of like a lexicon for naming geological and topographical features on Mars.
That's so cool. Navajo.
And so this rover is going along and naming things in Mars on Navajo. So it is obviously a language that is fit for the 21st century and fit for the future, right?
As long as you make it.
Name things on Mars. Mm-hmm. And you can do that in any language, like you know, or should be able to do that in every language, right? Like if you say that a language has to only be the way it was in the past, then, well, young people aren't going to be very interested in it. They need to feel like it's their culture is still alive and part of
and relevant.
Alive, I think, is participating in all the things that are happening now. Yeah, and relevant, exactly.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, would be very funny to have Low Saxon names on Mars. That would be cool. Sometimes we, for fun, rename certain places on Earth. And I like to think of it in Low Saxon terms. Like, for instance, New York. You're from New York, right? In Low Saxon, that would be Ni Erwervik.
Ni Erwervik.
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 Yeah.
Ni
Erwervik. Ni Erwervik. Because York is originally from Great Britain, right? The city of York. And that's a development from Jorvik, which is a Viking name. Mm-hmm. And the Vikings copied the name Eyrarvík, which means, you know, boar village. So it's very funny to think about it in those terms, like you're in from a new boar village or new boar region or something like that. So, but yeah, it's very cool to think about these things. But at the same time, it sometimes feels a bit off because that might be my own inhibition. Like my language isn't suitable for that, but at the same time, why not? You know,
why not?
Like, for instance, Berlin, that, you know, the city of Berlin, in Low Saxon, because it's actually in the Low Saxon area, would be Berlin. But since whenever we hear about Berlin in the Netherlands, we hear it in Dutch. So even in Low Saxon, we call it Berlin instead of Berlin. Jared, the difference. So and that's within our own region, right? So there's this strange thing where we copy instantaneously copy the words from, you know, the standard language, the you know, the umbrella language to which we model our Low Saxon, instead of, you know, looking what we already have. But at the same time, if you pronounce it like Baleen, people say, oh yeah, right, that would be correct, but it would be, you know, a bit puritanical.
Mm-hmm.
So is that a thing you hear across languages, or?
I definitely see these debates a lot in languages, for sure. I really need to start learning Yiddish so I can actually speak to how some of these debates play out in one of my languages. I'm trying to learn Hebrew right now first, which I suppose is mine, but a couple, mm-hmm. several centuries more removed. But but I see this in other languages.
Your first language is English, and yes. We spoke before, and you said Spanish is your second language, or, you know, mm-hmm. your partner speaks Spanish, or?
We both do. She's her family's from Cusco in Peru, and so, well, on her mother's side, and that side of the family, you know, if you go back two generations, we're mostly Quechua speakers. But you know, and Quechua's not, it you could call it at risk, but it's a really widely spoken language that young people are still learning, and it's very well resourced. That was the official language of the Incan Empire.
Mm-hmm.
And it's one of the most widely spoken indigenous languages on the American continent.
How many speakers?
At least a million, not more.
In the millions, right?
Yes. It's one of the few that's actually in the millions. It's kind of like Arabic in that it's often spoken about as a single language, but actually has a lot of divergent dialects that could reasonably be considered their own languages. And there's some mm-hmm. contention about this in the Quechuan world.
Same goes for Low Saxon. And okay. I think many, you know, marginalized or non-standard languages can be considered in that sense. That, you know, they get an umbrella term,
mm-hmm.
but in reality, there's lots of different variations, and yeah. So right. that's Quechua, but did that put you on the track of Wikitongues? Did that put you on the idea of Wikitongues, like Quechua?
Or? No. Also, I was going to say, I just looked up the number. When you combine all the Quechuan languages, it's up to 10 million speakers. So it's a very widely spoken language. Mm-hmm. My partner doesn't know Quechua, but one of her uncles is trying to reclaim the language, which is pretty cool. And I think it's a really neat language. It's one I would love to learn one day. Mm-hmm. I hope if we have kids, they can be native Quechua and Yiddish speakers. But anyway, what put me on the track to Wikitongues was actually Catalan, because my second language is Spanish, which I learned when I was in high school. After that, I learned Catalan, and you know, most European listeners know what Catalan is. It basically what happened was the first place I traveled to outside of Saragossa, which is where I was learning Spanish, was Barcelona, and I fell in love with it, and I thought that was really cool. I decided I wanted to learn Catalan, and strangely enough, in Saragossa, I had two Catalan-speaking professors, and so I started kind of learning on the side with them in parallel to Spanish. And a lot of people say that when you learn two similar languages, it can be really confusing. I found it really helpful because it helped illustrate what was unique about both languages, but also what were universal themes of all Romance languages. And so there was kind of a meta Latin genealogy and kind of etymology lesson that I was getting, and I really, really enjoyed that. And so learning them both actually kind of helped much more than harmed.
Mm-hmm.
So then I had an opportunity to live in Barcelona when I was 18 for a few months, and I was pretty fully immersed in Catalan there. By design, I did my best to avoid Spanish and English, which is difficult in Barcelona, but doable if you really try. Mm-hmm. You know, being immersed in the context of what I would argue is a successfully revitalized language, although some Catalan speakers may disagree, got me really excited about the possibility that marginalized languages could be reclaimed by their communities. And I think that, you know, there's a lot of solidarity between different language minorities in Europe. And so, you know, within not long of being in Barcelona, I was meeting Corsicans and I was meeting Greenlandic speakers and, you know, or Kalaallisut, and granted that's an Inuit language, and whether you'd actually consider it European is a separate issue, but they're under European control. Mm-hmm.
You could even consider it Canadian, right?
Only a Canadian nationalist could, I guess, because Canada, Greenland isn't part of Canada.
I know, but you know, they usually go across, and I think that I can imagine that would be easy.
And I would bet, and maybe you should get an Inuk person on here to talk to them about that, but I would bet that there's like, from what I understand, there's definitely like a pan-Arctic or a pan-Inuit identity, but I think that may transcend Canada. I think they would probably see Canada as an equally colonial presence. But I'm not the one to speak to that. But you know, I met a lot of, sorry.
Yeah, it was just cool to bring it up, you know, like I think in Low Saxon terms, you never think of Greenlandic languages.
Right.
But they might be very close by, because Low Saxon is actually one of the languages spoken in Denmark, and Greenland is still Danish territory, right?
Exactly. And that's how I ended up meeting Greenlandic speakers through getting involved with like Catalan language stuff. Because there would be like these minorities of Europe conferences, and there would be Corsicans and Cornish people and Occitans and Basques and you know, everybody, and Greenlandic people were there. And I think it just really helped distill for me how central language is to identity. And it also helped kind of open my world into this, into like an understanding of the scope and scale of linguistic diversity. I think intuitively, you know, growing up, I had no exposure to Scottish Gaelic or anything like that, but my dad, you know, would speak a lot of Yiddish to me in fragments, like phrases and words and things like that. So I always grew up with kind of the remnants of a family language. But it, you know, that didn't, the relevance of that didn't become clear until really my time in Catalonia. But anyway, I came back to the US and I wanted to get involved with language diversity, and that's what got me started on the road to WikiTongues.
Right. So, is it a daytime job now?
As of January, yes, where I am one of the two employees.
Wow.
So I'm excited about that.
Very
it's
nice.
It's taken a very long time for that.
Very exciting to see that, you know, project so close to your heart really taking off. That's, well, congratulations.
Thank you. Or in Yiddish, it would be a shinem dank.
Shinem dank. Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah, that it sounds a bit like German, because I met a few speakers of Yiddish, or at least I saw them. Mm-hmm. And they were, you know, chatting amongst themselves. And for some reason, I could understand them, because Yiddish is so close to German. It would be very interesting to talk to them. But, you know, they were more like the traditional Jews, and I didn't want to interfere. So,
right.
Yeah, it was very funny. And then I would love to have some speaker of Yiddish. So maybe you in the future on the podcast too. I have a conversation, a bilingual conversation in Low Saxon and Yiddish, and see how that works. Because I've been trying this many times with, for instance, speakers of Swedish even, and see how Low Saxon and Swedish would work together. And I've invited someone from England, from the UK, who is a specialist in Old Saxon and Old English, and to see to what extent Old Saxon and Old English would be intelligible with a speaker of contemporary Low Saxon. That would be very exciting. So lots of different ideas up here, and you know, it's great that we have the internet now, because that's given us a whole new, a new means of reaching out to people and showing people, shoving people under their noses, like, this language is still here and very much alive and very, very lively as well. So that's good.
I actually know some Yiddishists. If you want to do that at a faster pace than me becoming conversational in Yiddishes, I can introduce you to some people who'd be very happy. My friend Sandy Fox, for example, is a podcaster, and she runs a feminist podcast in Yiddish. It's called
Vibrant. That would be lovely. Nice.
So she could be great. She'd be a very good candidate for this exercise.
But it would be also be an extra incentive to you to start upping your game.
Yeah, for sure. The issue is that I'm starting with Hebrew right now. And that's taking some time, because Hebrew bears very little relationship to any language that I know. And so it really is like starting from square zero. I'm going to be preoccupied with that for the next several months. Mm-hmm. But I will get to Yiddish, and I will come when I'm feeling confident. We can do an episode in Yiddish. But in the meantime, you should get Sandy on, because I think that would be really cool.
That would be lovely. Yeah. Let's see if we can arrange something. So do you have like fixed goals for languages? Do you help people set them, or how does that work? So once people reach out to WikiTongues, how does that go? What can we expect?
Well, we don't have fixed goals for language revitalization. If you want to work with them, sorry, I've got a cat that's running around right now. We don't have fixed goals for language revitalization.
What's that in Yiddish?
A cat?
Mm-hmm.
I don't know. I probably like got, I would bet. Mm-hmm. Let me look it up.
A katzo or something like that.
Yeah, in Hebrew it's like hatul or something like that. There she goes. Let's see, cat in Yiddish. What is nice though is, because Yiddish uses the Hebrew alphabet, learning Hebrew is a step to Yiddish. I actually would play this game. There was a period in New York where I had to bike every day through a Haredi neighborhood where the signs were all in Hebrew or Yiddish. And I would look at the signs and, you know, it's all the Hebrew script, but I would try and determine based on like how the spellings were arranged or like how they sounded when I read it, whether it was Hebrew or Yiddish. A cat in Yiddish is katz.
I figured. Yeah. Something like that, yeah. And in Low Saxon, it's kata.
Kata, there you go. Yeah, I mean, Yiddish is Germanic with Hebrew and Aramaic thrown in. Mm-hmm. We don't have fixed revitalization goals for people who come to us with the intent of starting a revitalization movement. What we have is a method for identifying the vitality of their language and a method for thinking about what their language may need next. So in Wendy's case, Afro-Seminole Creole has only a couple dozen speakers left. It is under-resourced. And so there is a critical momentum turn that needs to happen, right? And so for her, the process was, well, you kind of need to seed a movement of interest in the language in the first place. So the goal that she set for the next year is getting 20 people to commit to learning the language. And she's going about that by hosting events. She's been doing some Zoom language sessions with some of the elders and with Ian Hancock, who's the linguist that produced the 1,000-word dictionary and grammar sketch that they have, which it's so thankful that he did that, you know. So that was one thing. Hangi in the Congo, his language Kihunde has a couple hundred thousand speakers. Children are starting not to learn it. So the language is at risk. I don't know if it could formally be classified as endangered yet, but it will be in a generation if they don't turn things around. And he has an incredible Kihunde language school in Goma, where he lives. Goma geographically is in the Democratic Republic of Congo on the border with Rwanda. And his school has about 20 students, right? It only has room physically for about 20 students, right? And so what he needs to do is standardize and scale his education program. So what he's working on is standardizing, well, A, upgrading some of their equipment, because right now all they have is a chalkboard. But in addition to that, creating some new materials for teachers, training new teachers so that more Kihunde children can start learning their language in a structured capacity, right? Kamran in Russia, his language Wahi is similarly at risk to Kihunde in that younger people aren't learning it as much, they're not using it as much. A large portion of the community still speaks it though. And so he wants to get people involved with keeping the language alive. And one issue they have is lack of resources. There are resources though. It's just that Soviet linguists produced them. And the working language of those resources is Russian, which is the language that most Wahi people don't speak. And they're in libraries in Russia, where most Wahi people don't live. So, but he does, and he speaks Russian. So he's translating these resources and digitizing them. And what I'm trying to encourage him to do also is to have a newsletter about that and like a Facebook group so that people back home can get excited about the activities as well. So it's not just a resource production. Like I think there's a way to do community organizing around the process of documentation. There's a really great story about this. It's this is a speaker who contributed a video to WikiTongues, but who we haven't like supported directly or worked with on revitalization. But he, his name's Luis, and he's a speaker of the Tenek language from Mexico. That's T-E-N-E-K. And he ran a documentation project where he got the youngest people in the community to record the oldest people in the community as a process of putting together like storybooks and things like that. So he identified that there was a lack of documentation and a lack of community organization. And he did the first thing to do the he did the second thing to do the first thing. And, you know, in engaging the young people in creating documentation, not only is he creating materials for future education, but he's also kind of engaging the community in keeping the language alive, right? So
exactly.
So it's a way to do both at the same time, right?
That's vital.
Yeah. When it comes to oral histories and like creating documentation, like goals that we would love, what we would love is to have at least 8 hours of video in every language in the world and a 3,000 word dictionary in every language. Because that, as long as the video is strategically captured and the dictionary is strategically elicited, that should be enough for anyone to go forth and do a revitalization project.
Luckily for Low Saxon, there's dictionaries galore. So that's good. I think that should work. But most of these dictionaries are offline and would be very much helped if those were made available online. I know there's one character who doesn't live too far away. He's compiled a dialexicon, is what he calls it, and he used to be a computer programmer, so he built his own software where you can look up Low Saxon words in Dutch and Dutch words in Low Saxon. And he's compiled a dictionary of over 80,000 words now. So
wow.
That's quite a lot, and it's very commendable whatever he did, and he's actually been knighted for it by the Netherlands. So that's a really cool story. But he's, for some reason, he's a bit stuck in his ways. Like, he doesn't want to make it available publicly to the public, right? For some reason, we need to start convincing him that the future is online, and that, you know, he says, like, if people are interested, they can buy the printed copy, or they can install my software. But people, you know, they don't want to install software anymore. They want to just Google it and be able to, you know, run a search in a search bar online. If he just sent us the word lists, right? Because it's a matter of zeros and digital stuff, really. And if you just sent it to us, you know, just if you want this to, you know, this is your legacy, right? You've done so much. Make it available while you still can. So
I couldn't agree more. I was just meeting with a linguist in Portland, Maine, which for the, you know, the European listeners is the very northeastern tip of the US. Mm-hmm. Or Maine is the very northeastern state. Portland is actually south in the state, but whatever. There's a linguist there. His name is Connor Quinn. He's an Irish American, so he's involved in the Irish language revitalization. And he's also involved in the revitalization of the Penobscot language, which is an indigenous language in the state of Maine.
Right.
And he recently collaborated on the production of a beautiful book in this language. And it's a collection of transliterated oral histories with parallel texts in Penobscot and English, key on like how to pronounce it, lovely illustrations, incredible work. And, you know, it's through a university press, so there isn't really a profit motive, but obviously the better the book does, the more likely the university will be to give them a second, to let them do a second volume. And they are finding ways to sell it. Like in the state of Maine, apparently it's a law that children have to learn indigenous history. So like if they could get it in part of the curriculum, then the school districts would have to buy it. But one thing they're very stern about is making sure that every Penobscot family gets it for free.
Oh, right. That would be lovely.
Because what are they making this for if it's not for them? Mm-hmm. Right. So anyway, I think there's like a common ground here where when you work on a project like this, you might be able to find other ways to monetize it, but you shouldn't be forcing the heritage learners to pay you. That just mm-hmm. feels kind of make a lot of sense to me. Mm-hmm. If the goal is keeping the language alive, truly.
Right. Well, you know, the character I was talking about is software is available for free online.
But, okay.
It's on a very obscure website that nobody mm-hmm. will be able to find if you don't know where to look for it, you know? So,
right.
And for some reason he said, I've done my part. Now it's up to the rest, which would be okay if he gave us, you know, to the coffers, really, you know, the repository he has collected, because, you know, he's done a massive amount of work for which he'll be applauded for years to come, you know, but at least have us have a look at how we can implement this for future generations and for online applications, right? Like, it should be a matter of us being able to, you know, run a search and one of your wonderful words will come rolling out. It should be one click away, not an installation and a search for a page somewhere in the back of the internet, right?
Right, right. For instance, if you have a bunch of parallel texts in different dialects, that should be enough to plug into like Google Translate.
Exactly.
Like their algorithm could all of a sudden like work with Low Saxon. Mm-hmm. And machine translation is a fantastic tool that if it's good, can be actually really helpful for language revitalization. Mm-hmm. Or, you know, it could be used for like a predictive text or, you know, like autocorrect, system, like ways to integrate it into the daily life of Low Saxon speakers and learners so that it, you know, it isn't something that is, kind of removed.
Mm-hmm. But there's the added problem that there isn't a standard Low Saxon language, rather mm-hmm. separate dialects, and these are spread out over the Netherlands and Germany, and mm-hmm. the Germans tend to model Low Saxon writing on High German, whereas Dutch people would write Low Saxon as if it was Dutch. You know, they use Dutch, you know, Dutch ways of writing Low Saxon. So Google Translate wouldn't see that this is one language, rather it would be confused, you know, Google Translate would be confused in that, well, this looks like High German and this looks like Dutch, so we'll treat this bit of language as if it was Dutch and we'll treat that bit as if it was High German. We actually have daily examples of that because I make a point of twittering in Low Saxon. Mm-hmm. But Twitter has this auto-translate function below every tweet. I get, for some reason, I get, sometimes it interprets my tweets as if it's Dutch. I've had people say, my translator says this is German. My translator says this is Swedish. My translator says this is Norwegian. This is Estonian, Afrikaans, even Hawaiian, for some reason. So we have a very long way to go in standardizing at least the written form of the language. And we've tried this, but then I think I've told you this before, but we've compiled a new way of writing this.
Mm-hmm.
But now the hardest part is convincing people to start using this new form, because they say this is, doesn't look like anything I've seen before. So we have a very conservative group of people working with this language. So that's the, that's the most difficult part.
Yeah, I completely agree that that like standardizing the orthography would be helpful. But you could probably still have these different dialects, because I think part of the problem is with machine translation is that Google or Twitter or like they don't even have Low Saxon in there. So it sees Low Saxon and just tries to guess what it might be. But if they actually had Low Saxon and it was based on a corpus that contained parallel texts from across dialects and orthographies, it could still possibly work. Like, for instance, I'm pretty sure if I were to go into Google Translate and I would go into Catalan, right? If I started writing in Valencian or if I started writing in Mallorcan, right? And they're like fairly divergent dialects. Some speakers actually consider them different languages, although that's linguists don't tend to agree with that formulation. But like I could type in any of those and it would recognize them because there's enough text in the different dialects that it still knows that this is Catalan or Valencian or Balearic, whatever you want to call it. And so I think the standardization is good, but Google Translate could also just like have a Low Saxon option that is based off of the different texts across dialects, and it should still be able to like translate the text as it's entered.
Mm-hmm.
And that's my understanding, though. I'm not like a natural language processing guy, so I could be completely off on that. That's based on my understanding.
You mentioned a corpus. I think one of the friends I made compiling this orthography, she is working on a corpus.
Cool.
Precisely for that reason. So, and she even goes as far back as the 1700s and 1600s. So just to incorporate every possible writing system everyone's ever devised, you know. So, and to have no misunderstanding ever again. Right. So, yeah.
Approached by a university to develop a course in Low Saxon? Use your orthography?
Yes, exactly. Yep. So that's a cool thing, and it's in the works, and it's due for April 2022. But we're still, you know, hashing out the details and or how we're going to go about this, because there is no English teaching material on Low Saxon. So I have to create everything from scratch, because this is an international setting and this has never been done before. So there is some teaching material for Low Saxon from Dutch, and there is some from German, but it has never crossed people's minds that there might be an interest in this language beyond its own speaker area, right? So yeah, it's in the works, but we need to get some details right first.
Mm-hmm.
It's positive that it's positive news that I'm asked to do this, and it's exciting. And they wanted to do a sort of what they call a studium generale, which is an open lecture like a TED talk, which is very cool. My contact at the university has said when I've been asking around, next to the English course, this would be very suitable to be done in Dutch as well. So would you be interested to do this in Dutch as well? So, and then the target group wouldn't be the students, but the teachers themselves and the staff at university. So that gives a whole new perspective, a whole new area of getting this language into the academic world. So that would be really cool, because this is actually the first time I think this university has ever done anything with the with this language. And they even have a language office. So you can follow courses in Dutch, you can follow courses on German, on English or Chinese, I believe, even, and other world languages. But to have this, local university that even carries the local name, have this, well, not so local language. Yeah, that's exciting. So
that's extraordinary. You know, what would also be cool, it comes to mind, since you have like a robust community working on this with you, is to because you mentioned TED Talks. You know, you're familiar with the distinction between TED and TEDx.
Mm-hmm. It's a TEDx sort of thing.
So you could get a TEDx. You probably could actually organize a TEDx conference in Low Saxon.
Would that be possible? Because I've looked into that and I think it was supposed to be in English, right?
Well, so official TED stuff that isn't TEDx has more restrictions when it comes to language, because they're pretty intense about vetting it, but they're a little looser with TEDx. And so I think that it's possible to do minority language or minoritized language TEDx conferences. Mm-hmm. I could be wrong on that, but I think that there's more freedom to innovate when you're organizing a TEDx.
And there's actually one very cool thing in that I have contacts at the university. There is one teacher, one professor of applied technology, robotics. I think it has to do with robotics, like the elderly who are now in homes for the elderly. They get lonely. So, for instance, she's working on a robot now that is more of a social robot. Like it talks to you, right? If you're lonely, it just has a conversation with you based on AI. But if you're from a Low Saxon speaking area, why would this robot be speaking Dutch to you? That would feel unnatural and would you know. So that's the sort of thing she's constantly thinking about. And it would be very cool to have a Low Saxon speaking robot. You know, how cool would that be?
And that would be very cool.
And, you know, she is a very public figure. And, you know, she's been speaking at festivals. And we have this very, very large music festival. Like, it's one of the biggest festivals in Europe. And they have the Universiteit, which is very funny because it's Universiteit University, right? Universiteit, mm-hmm. Universiteit. Like, they have this big party tent where they have these low-key lectures on all sorts of topics, which would be very cool to have those lectures in Low Saxon. Why not? Right? Make it the language of education.
Mm-hmm.
So there's loads of possibilities, which I think about a lot, which I need to voice more often, I think, to make people see that this is possible. Usually it's beyond people that this is possible in this language as well.
Right. And I mean, unfortunately, like, natural language processing is the name of the game with so much of this stuff. Mm-hmm. It's, you know, it really is just having like rich written and verbal corpora available for engineers to use. Because that's all you need for a Low Saxon speaking robot, or or for Siri or whatever to understand you if you speak to them in Low Saxon, or, you know, autocorrect to work. And I think being able to interact with devices in your language is critical. And one dream that I have, and it won't be this year, but maybe next year or the year after that, is to have an open pipeline for some of this. For people who want to actually submit that data to these big companies that are working on that stuff. So if you want autocorrect in your language, here's where to submit that to Apple or Google Speech. I think Google Speech does speech recognition, not autocorrect, but you know what I mean. Mm-hmm. I would love that.
I think I've tried it with Google Speech recognition. It doesn't recognize Low Saxon yet. But a friend of mine, who I've also recorded a podcast with in English, he's tried Low Saxon phrases and entered them into DeepL, you know, the translation tool from Microsoft, DeepL, you know, D-E-E-P-L. And it actually did pretty well. So it's in the works. Yeah, things are looking up. So, yeah.
I also know someone who he's like working on a project that's housed by Microsoft, and they're constantly looking for Corbra to build autocorrect in different languages. And I don't know if they have Low Saxon yet, but it may be worth speaking to him, because he'd be very happy to help with that. And
I'd love to know his name.
I know someone at Google Speech. I'm sorry.
I'd love to know his name.
His name's Nathan. I forget his last name, but I can put you in touch over email.
That would be lovely.
Yeah. And then I think I know someone at Google Speech too. I don't know how open their pipeline is, but I know that he'd always be happy to know that there's like a language community that wants it, because then he can try and prioritize it. And his name is Don Von Esch. He's pretty, he may be Dutch actually, now that I think about it. But he's pretty active on Twitter. So you can find him.
Does have a Dutch sounding name, yeah.
Yeah, and I've spoken to him before. I just can't remember if he's like of Dutch descent or if he's Dutch in the US. But if you just find him on Twitter, he's pretty active in language revitalization stuff, and he's at Google Speech. So you could just tweet at him and say, what's going on with Low Saxon?
I'd see how that works. His name was Don Van Esch?
Yes.
I think I've seen him before. Come across
him.
Yeah,
he's pretty active.
So I need to reach out to him then.
Mm-hmm.
All right. So let's try that.
Yeah.
Get things running. This is exciting. Yeah, very nice. So is there anything else you wanted to talk about? Because you actually started, you know, initiated this podcast.
Oh, yeah. I mean, we've covered a lot. We've covered all the things that I like to talk about. I think it was just fun to come on, and it would be fun to come on and talk about Low Saxon or just language revitalization more broadly.
This is actually pretty unique, because most talks on Low Saxon are either in Dutch or in German or in Low Saxon. So,
right.
Yeah.
Well, I actually had a question for you. So, you know, we've been posting a handful of Low Saxon videos on WikiTongues over the past few weeks, and one of them was of a language that could possibly be considered a Low Saxon variety, and that's Silesian, or no, not Silesian, sorry, that's Slavic, the Pomeranian language that's spoken by the diaspora community in Brazil. Mm-hmm. And what would you consider that, based on what you listened to, something that's under the Low Saxon umbrella, or
absolutely
kind of adjacent to? Okay,
absolutely, yes. I actually retweeted you, and mm-hmm. I got a lot of reactions from other speakers of Low Saxon. Like, this is just one-on-one Low Saxon, and it's very, very much recognizable. And even from speakers of Dutch who said, I've never heard this before, but I can understand it quite clearly. So how is that possible? So yeah, it's really lovely to see that a language that has actually been uprooted from its Pomeranian origins and, you know, been taken to Brazil of all places, thousands of miles away, and is actually thriving there. So that's a very cool thing to see. And they have the luck that they're in a remote area of Brazil, left to their own, resources, really. And it's become one of the state languages in that state of Brazil. So that's very, very cool. And it's a thing people from my region actually don't know much about. So, and it was retweeted by a number of quite well-known professors who are into the Dutch language. So they love to, you know, sort of say that this is a part of Dutch as well, but it isn't. So, yeah, there's an ongoing debate whether Low Saxon in the Netherlands should be considered part of Dutch. And then there's an ongoing debate in Germany whether Low Saxon should be considered a part of German. But you can make cases for both. But you can also say, well, as we said in the beginning of this podcast, if people want it to be a language, a separate language, then it is a separate language.
Right.
And if people voice this strongly enough, there's no linguist, well, maybe on linguistic grounds, to say that this is a part of their wider array of languages or wider array of dialects within their own constellation, right? If we look at, for instance, the Scandinavian languages like Danish, Norwegian, and Swedish, those are actually dialects of the same sort of language group. But since people from Sweden said these particular sets of dialects, this is what we consider ours, this is what we consider proper, and in Norway, people said, well, you can do whatever you like in Sweden, but these are our dialects, and this is what we consider Norwegian, but they're actually part of the same group. So it's always political.
Absolutely. I mean, it's the old quote that's attributed to Max Weinreich, the Yiddish-speaking linguist, that a language is a dialect with an army and a navy. What I always say when people kind of get into a fuss about whether this is a language or not is it's to me the wrong question, right? This will happen on videos that we publish sometimes. I remember we published a video of Torongo, which is a language from France. It's very close to French. And someone said, well, I mean, you know, obviously Frisian is different from Dutch, or like Catalan isn't Spanish, but this is French. How can this be a different language? Like, and you know, I basically replied, and I don't always reply. I often don't reply to comments on our YouTube channel. I often don't read them, but I happened to see this one, and I was like, I feel a need to respond to this, and so I responded by saying that, you know. First of all, from a linguistics perspective, mutual intelligibility is not the only metric that linguists use to classify one language from another, and that there is no consensus on how to do that. And one thing that is pretty clear, though, is that genealogy plays a role in this, right? So, like, if we know that Torongo developed independently alongside French, it's simply wrong to call it a dialect of French because French did not precede it. They both could be called Latin dialects. That would be a scientific statement, but to call this a French dialect is a political one. And at the end of the day, even if it did come from French, and now Torongo people want it to be standardized as a language that's unique to their community, like, let them. Like, who cares? Like, you're asking the wrong question. It doesn't matter whether they're two dialects of the same language or two separate languages, but that they both can continue to exist.
Exactly. And we get the same things with Low Saxon as well, because I happen to speak a very conservative variety of Low Saxon within the Netherlands, but there are also very highly influenced by Dutch dialects of Low Saxon. And I think below one of your other videos you posted on Twitter with a Low Saxon speaker from the more Western varieties of Low Saxon, some reactions actually said, well, this sounds like Dutch to me, with a bit of an accent.
Yeah.
But then again, who are you to judge, right?
Yeah. And with these things, with closely related languages, like, there are also dialectal continuums, right? So, like, between Scots and English, there is Scottish English, which sometimes leads more towards Scots and sometimes more towards English.
It's on a scale, right?
Yeah. And I think that's the biggest thing, is that classifying languages is political and for usefully politically useful reasons. Like, it's not always some like conspiracy to oppress us, but it's arbitrary. Mm-hmm. And it
and for educational purposes.
Educational purposes. I mean, there's a lot of reasons, and you know, but I think people kind of associate it more with like classifying different species, which is a bit more objective, although I'm sure if there were a biologist on this podcast, they'd probably say that I'm being reductive, and I probably am, but you know, two different species do have a slightly different kind of DNA going on, right? Like chimps are measurably and objectively distinct from humans. And you know, both of us are apes, and apes as a group are measurably distinct from monkeys and so on and so forth. Languages don't like are not like the it's not that clear cut. And I guess, you know, in biology, sometimes it's like subspecies and things like that. It starts to get a little murkier, like are wolves and dogs as separate species, I guess, but who knows? And but you know, it's with languages, it's a spectrum with culturally arbitrary and occasionally overlapping borders, and like that's okay. I think what confuses people who react in that sort of way is that they have a very kind of 19th century understanding of language as like a thing that's like very codified and in a box, and that corresponds to nation state borders. And when that starts to, you know, fray at the seams, it's confusing.
It's very confusing, and it's frightening. And yeah, maybe their, you know, polished variety of what they were speaking isn't as unique as they thought it was, and is, you know, as the model for everyone to follow. So yeah, and these are exciting times. So let's see where the ship goes. How far
we
sail.
Well, I think this has been a pretty cool conversation, and I appreciate coming on.
Thank you very much for coming on.
Because, absolutely.
This is very, yeah, it's exciting to speak on this in, you know, I've been talking about it in Low Saxon for a long time, and having this discussion in English really gives me and us a different perspective, because one thing I found when I was preparing the course for the university, I had a discussion with many international students, and they don't have the prejudices and the, you know, the misconceptions that usually exist within the Netherlands. Like this language is bad for you. Well, they've never heard of the language, so how would they know that? So,
absolutely.
So it was great to have you on and to hear your perspective on things and to see how things are working across the globe, that Low Saxon isn't unique in that it's, you know, for some reason shoved aside, you know, in favor of other varieties of languages. Mm-hmm. So, and to see that there's hope and that we can reverse this trend, and that, you know, it really depends on how you go about this and how much effort you put in together, right? So it's a community effort.
Absolutely. It's community organizing at the end of the day. It's social work, language revitalization. And there is a scientific element to it, but, you know, I think that's shouldn't be the barrier. It's possible. And it's, you know, it's happening everywhere. It just needs to happen a little bit faster.
Yeah, and that's where WikiTongues comes into play.
Hopefully, if we do things correctly and we grow correctly.
Well, yeah, I'd love to talk to you lots longer, especially on your toolkit. What's in your toolkit?
Sure. So the Language Sustainability Toolkit, it's a PDF that you can download in A4 letter or mobile formats. So for printing in different places or reading on your phone. And it has three sections, which are getting started, and that is about how to conceive of your movement, and that's identifying the vitality of your language, thinking about what it needs, thinking about how to measure success over time. Then there's documenting your language, so it has some, you know, protocols for creating and captioning videos, getting started with dictionaries. That section is going to be elevated a lot in the coming months with the oral history elicitation protocol we talked about earlier. And then there's revitalizing your language, or I think we call it promoting your language. And that's, you know, all of the different social processes that you can use. So it's effectively like, here's how you think about getting started, and here are your menu of options, and just go forth. And in each section has some worksheet questions if to like to directly ask you to think about certain things. And this is something that ideally we'll iterate on over the next 3 to 10 years, because, you know, the more we do this with different people, the more we'll identify things that we missed. And what we're trying to do over time is develop a kind of more universal theory of language revitalization.
It's a working document.
And when you download it, it actually says what the version is at the top, as if it was like software. So we're kind of in the process of hammering out like version 1.1.2 or something like that. And then what we're also working on is translating it into other languages besides English, of course, so that people can access it, at least in all the kind of global lingua franca. Because if we can get it into English, Spanish, Portuguese, French, Russian, Indonesian, Swahili, standard Arabic, Chinese, specifically Mandarin, if we can get it into like a broad enough, you know, Hindi, right? If we can get into a broad enough range, we should be able to, it should be intelligible to speakers of most languages, if not all languages, since there are very few people who don't speak any of those languages anymore. And if people want to translate it into their own languages, they can. Like, I know we have someone who did it in a Frisian, which was fun. And so on. I think we're getting it into Tamil soon. But if you go to wikitongues.org, you can download the most recent version. Just know that there are some newer versions coming in a couple months.
Right. So,
and that's just wikitongues.org/toolkit.
wikitongues.org/toolkit. Look it up, folks. It's exciting. And it's really a very useful tool, because I downloaded it, I think, a few iterations back. And yeah, there's awesome. There's really useful stuff in there. Stuff I'd been doing for ages, and now seeing how I've been on the right track. So that's a nice confirmation. So excellent. thank you for doing this for you know, millions of people around the globe. So it was a pleasure to talk to you, and I'll put it online as soon as I find the time to process it all. And well, thank you very much again, and I hope to talk to you soon.
Thank you. Shunam donk, and tudalaba. And remind me what it is in Saxon, Low Saxon?
Dankenswert.
Dank?
Yeah, so that's comparable, right?
Uh-huh. Yeah.
Dankenswert, so it's thankensworth, really.
Dankenswert.
Dankenswert, yeah.
Dankenswert. Dankenswert, Martin.
Yeah, and Godgang.
Godgang,
which means go well, go good.
Oh, that's fun. In Yiddish, there's a saying like that. It's Gegesundheit, which means go in good health.
Mm-hmm.
But it can be used facetiously too if you're annoyed at someone. You can be like, oh, fine. Like if you want to end a conversation. Mm-hmm. So it can be used earnestly or snarkily.
We should introduce that one for Low Saxon. Like, Godgang, yeah, thank you very much. I've heard enough now. Yeah, Godgang.
Yeah. There you go.
All right, thank you very much.
Thank you, and I look forward to keeping our ongoing conversation alive.